Colonel Harper, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
At a place called Freshford, near Bath.
Which year was this?
1910.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was in the Indian Army too. He was in the, at that time, 84th Punjab Regiment, which later became part of the 1st Punjab.
Did you go to school in the Bristol area?
To start with, yes. We did 2 terms at Mountain Coombe School, junior school, outside Bath. And then, that's my mother and me. And then we went to school in a private school in Buckinghamshire after that.
How did your schooling continue after that?
The usual performance. We went to a public school called Blundell's near Tiverton, but at that time we were living most of our time in Devonshire.
Did you go to Sandhurst?
Yes.
What was your course like there?
The usual course for that at that time, 1929-30. Very strenuous. More physical than educational. But there was plenty of military history as well, and also of course on economics, which was quite useful. But the physical part was very strict and very excellent standard of drill. Riding course for everybody, a lot of PT, and a certain amount of cross-country manoeuvring and trench digging and that sort of thing, very much based on World War One.
Was your ambition to go into the Indian Army?
Yes, I always was.
And did you go straight from Sandhurst to India?
Yes.
To join whom?
Well, we had to do a year with the British Regiment in India before we were posted to an Indian unit. And I happened to go to the 2nd Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers.
Whereabouts?
They were in a place called Wellington, down in Denbury Hills, when I joined them. And after about 6 weeks there, we moved north to Ferozepur in the Punjab. And then I went on detachment with my company to Amritsar. And then we finished up our term in a hill station called Dangshire on the way up to Simla. All the soldiers had part of the summer in this hill station.
Were the Lancashire Fusiliers called out in aid of the civil power whilst you were with them?
No, I don't think they were. We were ready for it.
And after the Lancashire Fusiliers, you went where?
I went to a cavalry regiment called the Royal Deccan Horse.
What were they like as a military unit?
They were very efficient. They were, well, I think they were the most efficient cavalry regiment there was. We thought we were anyway. We always got very good marks from any annual inspections that came on. They got the Royal title. They were the only regiment that got the Royal title in World War One, because they did so well then.
And what kind of duties did you have with them pre-war?
Well, when you joined, you became a squadron officer, which was a sort of assistant British officer, second in command of a squadron, probably.
Where did they recruit from, the Royal Deccan Horse?
Well, we recruited one squadron of Sikhs, one of Jats, which are Hindus from the Delhi Vertic area, and one of Muslims. In our case, they were Muslims from Hyderabad State, where the regiment had originally been raised. But after about 2 years, they found that the policy was that there weren't enough recruits. But there were 3 regiments that recruited from that. So they changed to the Punjabi Brahmins, PMs, as they called. So we then had a mixture of Deccan Muslims and Punjabi Muslims in C Squadron, which was the one I first joined. They got all that. And by the time World War II came along, we still had quite a lot of Deccan serving, mostly NCOs and the CIX.
Did the Deccany Muslims make good soldiers?
Yes. The good ones did, but there weren't enough to go around because the cavalry had been organized and reorganized in groups. And the group of three regiments were all recruited in the same manner. So the Deccanese now had to provide recruits for three regiments. And they didn't reckon there were enough in a big war to keep up the standard.
Was there any mechanization in the unit pre-war?
No, absolutely none. We did manage to get four motorcycles in about 1934, I think, and for communication. And they then survived those very well. You'd get across country on them too.
What kind of role was the regiment performing in India pre-war?
Well, where we were stationed to start in Pune, I think we were part of a force which would have been called on to go overseas if a war started. But like any other unit, we also had to be ready for internal security if required.
What, were you called out in aid of the civil power?
No, we never were.
Had you expected a war to break out, personally?
Well, no, not really, because we were taught at Sandhurst when I was there that chances are there'd never be another major war in our lifetime. The British government also at that time, I'm certain I'm right in saying, had this 10-year plan, which was that there wouldn't be another war for another 10 years, and finance could be arranged on that basis. Of course, when 10 years were up, they always extended to another 10 years.
So what was your reaction when you heard the news that Neville Chamberlain had declared war?
Well, by that time we knew it was coming. We began to get ready for war in about 1936 or 7 because of the rise of Hitler and the Nazis. But we still were on horseback with horse transport and the infantry too. And there just wasn't the resources to recognize us until the war began.
I think
it was done on a very economical basis.
You spent a period from 1938 to 1940 as part of what you describe as the Bengal bodyguard. What was that?
Well, the governors, the viceroy, had a bodyguard rather like the Hussar cavalry in London, because he was a sort of king's representative. And the provinces, the three provinces, which were the big divisions in India, Bombay, Madras and Calcutta, they each had a governor who came next to the viceroy in importance. And he was a sort of local royalty too. So they each had a bodyguard of two troops of high-stroke cavalry. Scarlet uniforms and all that sort of thing for special for ceremonial occasions. And we regular officers used to take in turns to be seconded to one of these bodyguards to look after them.
So it wasn't that the Royal Deccan Horse was taking a turn as the Bengal bodyguard?
No, it was a separate unit. These provincial bodyguards were a separate unit, and incidentally they were not actually paid or recruited by the army. They were paid by the local government, provincial government, and we recruited our own men and bought our own horses and trained our own horses and our own recruits. So we were completely independent in that respect. On the other hand, we were we were issued with normal weapons, and we could be turned out if required as normal troops.
Was there ever any question of any possibility of any terrorist or assassination attempt against the governor?
Well, yes, they were in Bengal, certainly. They were always ready for that, and quite a lot of the senior ICS officials were killed by terrorists. The actual governor, well, I think one governor was shot. I can't remember when. Certainly Sykes, the governor of Bombay, who had a murder attempt on him while we were in Pune at the prize giving at Pune University. The student tried to shoot him. But the pistol wasn't very powerful and the bullet hit a cigarette case or something and he wasn't hurt.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there. We heard all about it there. One of the ADCs tried to draw his sword and the whole thing came out, the scabbard and all came out of his belt, which didn't work out very well. He got a telegram from his brother in England who read about it in the press. Well done, mother's brave boy.
And Sykes was the governor of Bengal, was he?
Yeah. No, this was Bombay.
Governor of Bombay.
Yeah, when we were in Pune.
But there weren't any such attempts on the governor of Bengal whilst you were the bodyguard?
No. He had a proper bodyguard as well, you know, a plainclothes man with a pistol under his armpit.
Now, you were in India in 1942 when the so-called Quit India movement was on. Did you see anything of that?
Well, the Quit India movement had been going for years, all the time I was there, as far as I remember. We occasionally saw a little demonstration or something, people marching about the streets shouting.
But did you see anything more serious?
No, I don't.
Can you tell me how you came to be a Gurkha in 1943, please?
Yes. In 1943, we had at last got some tanks and were mechanized. But we still hadn't gone to the war. And Wingate started this long-range penetration effort, which they called the Chindits for short. And he got to hear of Roosevelt and Churchill, who thought it was a good idea. And he was allowed to ask for recruits from all the units in India, with officers for this force. And quite a lot of us volunteered because we hadn't been to the war yet. And we thought we'd better go before it was all over. And in fact, 7 regular officers of my regiment transferred to infantry about that time. So I was accepted for the Chindits, and I went in with, and I was posted to the 4th Battalion of the 9th Gurkhas, and joined them in a place called Jhansi, Central Provinces, in I think February 1944, and went into Burma with them a month later.
What impression did the battalion make on you when you first came in contact with it?
Well, they'd had a very hard summer, I mean winter, training in jungle warfare. And they were extremely keen, and their keenness was terrific. And the morale was terrific. Wingate had managed to get them really enthusiastic about this expedition, and they were learning all sorts of things they never had a chance to learn before, because he had access to unlimited ammunition and bombs and grenades. And when I joined this battalion in a camp, there were explosions and firing going on all around the place with people practicing.
What kind of preparations did you make to go into Burma?
We went on training, but jungle warfare, finding our way through the forest, weapon training as much as we could, because that's the most important thing, crossing rivers, swimming. Learned a little bit about how to survive in the jungle when the rations were short. And tactics suitable for operating independently in a forested country with no roads, no transport, and nothing else. And new rules, of course, we had to learn how to work them.
Did Wingate himself come round to visit?
He came round quite often and gave us a pep talk.
What impression did he make?
He was a complete sort of fanatic. He was like a sort of messiah. And he got everyone very enthusiastic. He did succeed in that.
What was his appearance?
Slightly different from normal. He had a beard, burning eyes, an old-fashioned loosely helmet on his head. You couldn't forget him once you'd seen him.
Do you remember anything he said to you?
I can't quote it offhand, but it's all in the head. There's a very good speech he made, which we've all got written down, about going in there and words exactly. There was a certain religious tone to it. May God give us the grace to behave ourselves as we should, and having done what we ought to, come out wiser and better men or something like that.
How did you feel about the religious tone?
Oh, well, we were quite impressed. I mean, in those days, most of us had been brought up to go to church or Sundays. And we respected anyone who believed in religion and God. In fact, most of our officers did themselves. We had an argument about it once after the war. And Bernard Ferguson said, who was one of our brigadiers, said the same thing. I just don't know how you can go on if you don't believe in an afterlife and heaven. Some of us were talking about it's just a possibility, it might be all over.
Which column did you go into yourself? Or which
the fourth night was divided into two columns called 49 and 94. And I went into 94. It was commanded by a man called Peter Kane. Of the ninth, or regular ninth worker. And each column consisted of could act independently in the jungle. We were supplied entirely by airdrops. And we had each column had an infantry company, a machine gun platoon, a mortar platoon, a mounted infantry platoon on ponies for reconnaissance. And they could also carry wounded. A pioneer platoon, could blow things up. And the Burma Rifles platoon, which were not good, because they were Burma people from the old Burma Rifle regiments, actual Burmese or Burmese tribes, who knew the language and knew the people there to some extent. And they were to be used for reconnaissance, long-distance reconnaissance, and not so much for... They were not supposed to be put in the forefront of the battle.
How did you get to the Burma border?
We went by train, most of the way. And we were within a few miles of the border up in Assam, completing our training. And finally, one brigade walked in over the Leader Road, that was Ernest Ferguson's brigade, but the rest of us flew in and guided. That was decided on quite late in the day, and I suppose when the wind managed to get hold of the necessary aircraft. And it was quite a surprise to us. We thought, when we first tried, we thought we'd better walk in.
Do you think that the training you'd had prepared you adequately for going in?
Yes, absolutely. We hadn't had any training in flying, so we couldn't use parachutes for one thing. Besides, you can't parachute a mule, at least you couldn't then. But learning to go again by gliders was no problem. We were just shown a glider and said, oh, it's only meant. You walk in through the door here and like, sit down then over there. And you get out and it lands.
What happened when you actually went in?
Well, everything went all right. For some reason, the Japanese are not capable of flying at night, or didn't want to. And the Americans, we had an American Air Force contingent with us. They laid on landing strips with bright lights. Southeast Row, and we landed at these places. One place had problems with a few crashes when they first landed, and they had quite a lot of casualties. But there was no interference from the enemy. And where we landed, I don't think we had any crashes at all. That was our landing strip was one on the east bank of the Irrawaddy, which had been kept in reserve in case the others weren't more usable. We had found that one of the others was not usable, and some logs had been left lying on it. Our brigade landed at just one of the Charlie landing strip on the east bank. These landing strips were natural open spaces in the jungle, which didn't need much improvement to allow a plane to land on flat grass. So the people in the gliders improved the landing strip as much as they could, and then the rest of the force, the mules and the heavy equipment, flew in the Dakotas, which could land and then take off again.
Which did you go in?
I was left behind to bring the mules in the Dakotas, because being a cavalry officer, I was supposed to know how to handle animals.
And what was the flight in the Dakota like?
The flight in the Dakota was okay. We had no trouble at all. Luckily, they remembered to make loading ramps to walk the mules up into them. When you think of the planes today, it's amazing that the closest door was only about 4 feet from the ground. But still, the mules couldn't jump into it. They could jump out. And we moved these ramps around the various planes. I think we loaded 60 planes with the mules that night. And then we had to take them all out again because we were told we had a message that the landing strips weren't good enough for them to go to land. So we got them all out again, and then we had to load up again the next night, and finally flew in, and we had no trouble. One mule misbehaved, I heard later, in one of the flights, and was shot. And nobody knew what it was doing when the plane flew back to India. There was this dead mule in the fuselage. And they suddenly held a court of inquiry and did a post-mortem. She might have died.
What was your column supposed to do on arrival at Chowringhee?
Well, we were going to operate up the Chinese border to the east, interfere with the Japanese use of the road which runs up from Burma to Machida on that side of the river. ambush convoys and so on, and link up further north with some Kachin local force that a man called Herring was trying to raise for as a sort of resistance. But he didn't succeed, he didn't achieve very much. We did a few ambushes, but we were able to do some ambushing up that road, and the 4th Ninth Corps finally ended up at Michinar, which is the furthest north town, or rather on the east bank of the river opposite Michinar, and did what they could there. But by that time I'd left him.
What was your first contact with the Japanese, close up?
First contact was a very small one. One lorry came along the road while we were crossing it. We put down an ambush position while we were there. And it went over a mine and we burnt it. The two men jumped out, one was killed immediately. The other was unarmed and hidden in some bushes and was grabbed. Well, Japanese prisoners were very rare, and we were supposed to keep them very carefully and send them back. So we did our best with this man. I don't know what happened to him then. I suppose we got him back somehow. But he was an unfortunate little ex-clerk or something who had been conscripted in. He wasn't, but didn't appear very formidable. Then the next lot was more impressive because we ambushed another lorry further on. That had 10 Japanese in it. And although it went over a mine, the lorry went over a mine, and we opened fire on them at once. They jumped out very fast, dashed into the jungle to one side. They fought back as best they could. They ran out into some paddy fields and lay down behind the bunds, which are little banks between the paddy fields, and returned our fire. We killed them all, but it took instead of a lot to be killed in the first burst, as would be supposed to happen on maneuvers. It took us about 40 minutes to kill them all, and we had to kill them all because they wouldn't surrender. And our soldiers were quite impressed by this performance. We didn't suffer at all, we didn't suffer a scratch. They'd been firing back at us, but they never hit anyone.
Was that bad marksmanship?
Not really, but because they were doing, they were in uncomfortable positions, hiding behind these buttons, firing from behind them. They were under machine gun fire themselves, and we were in the scrubby jungles where they couldn't really see us very well, whereas they were out there.
What
they weren't particularly good marksmen.
What did the Gurkhas say to you about the Japanese performance?
They said, "My goodness, what kind of men are these?" So they didn't die in vain, I think one might say, due to the impression they created.
What did the Japanese bodies look like close up?
Well, what I saw of them, they appeared to be clean, personally. They wore rather...